Last weekend, I attended the meeting, the biennial assembly of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. The Union of American Hebrew Congregations is the coordinating body of liberal synagogues. I had been invited to speak, and I had been assigned the title Jewish Identity. Now, Jewish identity is, as you may guess, a surmise, a rather awkward shorthand label for the question, how can we go about the difficult process in this age of keeping Jews Jews, of keeping young Jews happy being Jews? I spoke to you 2 weeks ago of the background of what I was going to say. I told you that I was not going to deal with technique so much as with thought, with some of those conventional habits of thought into which we have fallen because we are children of the 20th century, habits of thought which make it very difficult for us to offer clear answers and clear reasons and clear explanations to the question, you know, why remain Jews? What difference does it make? Can't one be a good human being? Does one also have to be a good Jew? And I dealt with such issues there as the question of abstraction. That is, how we go about conceptualizing, dealing with the larger issues and the larger truths. We're children of a scientific age. And we know that science has proceeded to its great accomplishments by looking behind the world of data, the world of appearances, to the concepts which underlie the visible phenomena. Science is always seeking to deduce from the observable world the basic equations which would explain all action and all motion and all being. The process that we use is the process of abstraction. It's been a very successful and very important technique for us in learning the natural law, the ways of nature, how to control nature to our benefit. But when we apply this process of abstraction, which is so effective in the world of science, to the world of feeling, to the world of love, to the world of aesthetic experience, to the world of spiritual expression, we find there that there are certain limitations to its effectiveness. For if we always look behind the sacred act and behind the sacred custom or the sacred moment and seek out the basic theory, the sociological or the anthropological equation concept, we will lose the ability to fulfill ourselves, to express ourselves, to find encouragement in the moment. You know, if you parse love and you look for all of the psychological phenomenon which may be involved in the opening of oneself to another and the pleasure one receives in another, you may never be able simply to love. You may so rationalize your feelings that you lose the ability to simply to feel. I remember some years ago attending a lecture about a particular painting. The art historian who was giving the lecture was a very learned man and a very intelligent man. And he explained how this painting was part of a genre, and he gave many of the ancillary preceding evidences of other canvases which dealt with the same theme. He talked with us of the laws of harmony and symmetry, of color, of perspective, how these had been managed by the artist skillfully in this case. He dissected the picture to such a point that as I walked out, I heard one lady say to her companion, you know, I really used to enjoy that canvas. Somehow he had so intellectualized the experience that she had lost her ability simply to experience. And what is true of art and true of love is true of the religious moment. It's easy to describe the etiology of a custom, how it grows out of some primitive feeling, to deal with the anthropological data which come to us from Java or from the Philippines or from the Near East, wherever it may be, to deal with taboo and magic and all of that, and to analyze why it is that custom and ritual satisfies certain deep feelings within us. But after all the analysis is complete, and after we understand all this data, and it's important that we understand it if we're academicians, in religion, as in any emotion, the experience is the thing. And our ability to open ourselves up to the moment, to find in it its sacredness, its kernel of holiness, is after all the critical issue. And unfortunately, this critical process of analysis often makes it very difficult for us simply to enjoy and participate in and find meaning within the religious life. Now, this particular session was divided into four parts. I made a presentation, and then there were a series of questions from the floor. And then, since everybody in this large ballroom was divided by tables, the tables turned towards each other, and there was a discussion at the various tables. And then some of the tables, on the basis of the discussion, asked some more questions of me. The first set of questions tended to be practical and procedural. One after another, the people there got up and expressed the ways in which their particular congregation was encouraging the religious life, or their frustration about the fact that their congregation was unwilling to give itself over to the easily and uncritically at times to the religious experience. But after the table conversations, after there'd been a moment of sharing together, the questions tended to get down to rather more interesting and more philosophic issues to deal with the questions of thought that I had tried to deal with. And I remember one lady got up and she said to me, in effect, "Rabbi, isn't it true that Reformed Judaism, by diminishing the importance of the family, has somehow contributed to this crisis of Jewish identity?" My first response to her, the public response that I gave, was to deny her question categorically. I reminded her that almost as its very first reform, Reformed Judaism had tried to bring the family together. We'd taken down the mechitza, the barrier which separated men and women in the synagogue. We'd brought the women down from the balcony into the family pew. The family should celebrate together. I suggested to her that there was not a congregation anywhere that did not have any number of celebrations of religious moments which were geared to the family, children and parents alike. And I suggested to her that I was sure that there was not an adult education group in any synagogue in which home observance was not emphasized. But as I began a little later to think over this question, I bethought myself of this, that somehow she had picked up the very theme that I was trying to express, that just as Reformed Judaism, because of the very openness, the very sensitivity which we affirm to the thought patterns of our day, we declare ourselves not only to be interested in the tradition, but in the moment, and to try to blend these two, the existential and the historical, together. That just as we had fallen into certain conventional habits of thought because of the world in which we lived in the matter of Jewish identity, so I suspect, as I thought about it, that we have fallen into certain patterns of thought, certain attitudes, perhaps unconsciously, which do, in fact, reflect a diminished sense of importance, sense of significance about the family. Now, behind her question, I would suggest there are two premises. The first is the premise that the family is, in fact, the basic unit through which social memories, historical traditions, are passed on from generation to generation. And the other premise is this, that there is an instinctive, basic, elemental connection between Jewish values, the Jewish tradition, and what the family stands for. And I'd like to examine briefly these two before I examine the larger question of how it is that we as contemporaneous people, as moderns, have reflected perhaps unconsciously some of the doubts and questions which are being expressed by others about the significance of the family. Let's look at the family as the basic unit through which social memories, historical traditions, and loyalties are molded. Now, the family is the link between the past and the present and the promise of ties into the future. I think that's clear. I know that Hanukkah lights, since we're coming to the Hanukkah season, the four questions of the Seder, the blessing of the wine, the songs and the chant of the Kiddush, the Bible stories and the Bible wisdom are part of my soul in large part because I first saw the lights kindled as I was cradled in the arms of one of my parents, and I heard the Bible stories and something of the Bible tradition as I sat on their lap or on their knee. The child is trusting. The child has no censors. The child is convinced that the secure world of the family is, in fact, the world in which truth exists. And somehow, being open and receptive at that moment in time, he receives those basic impressions, that emotional conditioning, which to a very large degree never leaves him. In the book of Proverbs, we find an acute observation which is phrased by way of an admonition. There's also a comment which I believe to be true. Train up the child in the way that he should go, and he will follow you all the days of his life. That somehow those first early years of trust and confidence are the years in which the content of our soul is to a large degree shaped. Oh, we will change, and we will make decisions, and we will find ourselves as life goes on. But we are, to a very large degree, we have what these early years allow us to be. I think there's no doubt that the family is the link between the past and the present and the ties to the future. Now, what about the link between Judaism and the family? Now, to be sure, you can hardly pick up a liturgy or listen to a lecture without knowing that the family is praised. There are encomiums, endless encomiums in the Jewish tradition to the mishpacha, to the family. The Jewish family was lauded and praised, and when I was younger, I was put off to a very large degree by much of that praise, because no group is perfect. We are simply human, and it's simply the truth that there have been in our past families which were cruel to one another, families in which there were husbands who beat wives and wives who deserted husbands, families where the parents were cruel and arbitrary with their children. The Jewish family has not been universally a glorious institution. But by and large, historically, Jews have tended to be concerned with the quality of family life to a degree which was not always apparent in the world about them, in the larger world. There is a story in the Bible which is perhaps appropriate. In the book of Numbers, we read that when the tribes of Israel moved from their rather permanent encampment in the Negev at Kadesh Barnea, they'd come to this camp several years out of Egypt. They remained there for about 36 or 37 years before they moved on and began their trek through what is today Jordan towards Jericho and their entrance into the Promised Land. Once they moved from this permanent camp, they passed through several countries and defeated the armies of those countries. And as they approached Edom and Moab, two of the larger countries east of the Jordan, the kings of these countries were afraid to face the Israelites openly. And one of them, Balak, the king of Moab, hired a prophet to come and to curse Israel. The prophet's name, according to the Bible, is Balaam. What we have here is essentially the same kind of phenomenon we associate with some of the Caribbean islands, where a shaman will take a doll and stick a pin into the doll, and the doll represents some enemy of the person who has hired the shaman to do so. It's the power of the taboo, the power of voodoo. The ancients believed that a prophet under inspiration spoke the word of God or of the gods, and the words of the gods having been spoken, they would be effective. And therefore, if a prophet under inspiration cursed a people, that people was accursed. And it was to achieve this end that the king hired the prophet. But according to the Torah story, when Balaam came to the mountain peak from which he would speak out his words, the oracle against the Israelites, and performed all of the ritual through which he was inspired, he looked out upon the Israelite camp, and instead of a curse, words of blessing came to his mouth. God put words other than the intended words into his speech. And we use as the very opening of our Sabbath worship one of the great poems which came from this prophet hired to curse, who ended up by blessing, Matovu Aholecha Yaakov, Mishkanotecha Israel. How beautiful are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. And the exegetes, the biblical commentators, have always taken this text as a comment, the comment of the non-Jewish world about the loyalty and the love and this calmness and the decency which was to be observed in the better Jewish homes, to observe generally in the Jewish community. There has been a special quality to the Jewish home, which has been to a large degree fostered by the religious spirit. Almost everything that happens to us in life happens to us within the familiar context of home, of marriage, family. I suspect we have here part of the explanation of Jewish survival. If Jewish family life had been miserable and dreary and cruel, I think the will to survive would long since have been drained from our people. For what reason would the children have had to maintain and continue the traditions of the parents? But there we are. We have a tradition. A tradition which emphasizes the importance of the family. Again, permit me an historic incident, this time one from our own century. When the second Aliyah, the second in the larger of the early groups of immigrants, of pioneers, came up to Palestine in the first decade of this century, those men and women who were then in their teens, at most in 20 or 21, who ended up as the leaders of the new state in the 1940s, most of them were young. They were revolutionary firebrands from Eastern Europe. They came out of the socialist underground of Tsarist Russia. They had come to Palestine, many of them simply because the anti-Semitism of the European socialist movements precluded their being wholehearted partners in the attack against the Austro-Hungarian or against the Russian tyranny. And they came with all of the ideas of revolutionaries, that they would create a new world, a new state of being. Community in the old sense, authority in the old sense, family in the old sense were anathema to them. Marriage was an anachronism inappropriate to this age. And among these young people, there was at least one who was in his middle age, a man by the name of A.D. Gordon. Gordon had been a minor office holder in Odessa. He was a man just about 50 when he came to Palestine. An elder among young people. But he was a man of unusual spirit who worked side by side with them, asked no special privileges because of his middle age. And he became to these young people something of a mentor, of a spiritual leader, a guru, I guess we'd say in the modern sense of the word. He is the man who spun out for them the religion of work, which was their expression of what they were doing, of the importance of hard work, physical labor, agriculture, and bleaching out the poisons of European contamination. But he also said something to them that they had not expected. And it was a warning that he spoke to them out of his experience as a man who was married and a family and all that. Bli chaye mishpacha lo yibane am. Without the experience of family living, no nation can ever be built. Unless you are willing to raise children within the context of family, unless you are willing to experience the long common planning of husband and wife for their future, your lives will always be distinct and separate, each going its own way. You will never learn the arts of sharing, of cooperation, of sacrifice one for the other, which are the arts of communal living. And your children will not feel the sense of responsibility to that for which you care, for which you have sacrificed your lives, which will allow a true community, a true nation, a state to emerge. So if we examine the axioms, the premises of the question which was asked me that day in San Francisco, clearly the woman was right on both counts. The family is critical to the continuation of a religious tradition. And the Jewish tradition deems the family to be critical and essential to all that it holds to be consequential. Now, when we come to practical matters, no one can gainsay that in our century the family has not been buffeted about by all matter of sociological and demographic change. Most of our grandparents lived in homes in which there were three generations, 10, 12, 15 people. Grandparents, parents, and children alike, grown children as well as younger children. And the family was often in their day both a roof, a house, a place to live and to share a meal, and a common business enterprise, a cottage industry. There were concerns that were shared. The well-being of the one was the well-being of all. Children, parents, and grandparents worked at the store, in the family business, whatever it was. Now here we are, 70, 75 years later. There are three, four people in a home, one and a half generations. The parents, children below 17. The grandparents are in their own apartment. The older children are out in the world doing their own thing, making their own way. The family has been diminished in size. There have been changes. But then there have always been changes in the nature of the family. The biblical family, the mishpacha, according to the Bible, is a unit of several hundred people. The patriarch and his wives, his children, grown and young, the grown children's wives, their children, and servants and slaves who have been adopted into the family. And the mishpacha in those days was a completely self-sufficient unit of production and survival. between that biblical family and the family of our grandparents, there were many changes. And again, we have been forced to live through the change. But if we analyze the functions of the family, we find that some of the major functions certainly can continue to be met and to be provided for by the nuclear family if, in fact, there is the will on the part of those who are family members so to sustain it. What is a family, essentially? A family is the unit within which our most intense and basic emotional relationships are established and maintained. Outside the family, there's general companionship. Within the family, there are lasting relationships, demanding relationships and deep relationships. The family is the basic unit through which children are natured and nurtured and provided for, in which they learn to love because they are loved. And finally, the family is the basic unit in which you'll always be welcome. Whatever happens to us in the world out there, when illness or need or accident occurs, here is the place where we are not alien. We can always come back to. There are no intake procedures. Someone is always there to open the door and to take us in. Now, I submit to you that these three basic functions of the family can be sustained by the nuclear family with difficulty, but they can be sustained, provided there is the will to do so. Now, what is unique about our century, the half century which preceded this, is that for the first time in world history, voices were raised which condemned the family, which challenged the family, which declared the family to be subvertive of fundamental ends, which were unhappy with the family because the family limited the self-fulfillment of the individual. This criticism of the family came from two sources. One source is ideological, and the other source is attitudinal. The ideological source is largely European. It's largely to be associated with the emergence of socialist and communist Marxian dialectics. The Marxians generally look upon the family as anachronism, as a way in which the dead hand of the past maintains its grasp on the present, precisely because the family is the effective means of maintaining social memories. It is anathema to the Marxian tradition. They want to put all the past behind. They want to break the hold of the family, the sense of particularity, of specialness within the family, the sense a family may have that certain claims of the class or of the state may not, in fact, be right. They want to do away with all of these so that the state, the class, can re-educate the individual to suit its own purposes and needs. The attack of the Marxist upon the family is precisely a statement of the significance of the family. That it is through the family that true individuality emerges. It is the family alone which allows our culture to be pluralistic, to have variety. It is the family which alone maintains sets of values and sets of traditions which are not materialistic, which are not simply those of the class of which we are declared to be a part. The other set of concerns, of challenges, of criticism of the family emerge from, largely in our own society, from two attitudes. The first is the attitude which glorifies and worships independence, autonomy, and the other is the attitude which worships spontaneity, always being genuine. In our society, many have made an absolute god of independence, of doing of one's own thing, being on one's own. And obviously the responsibilities of the families, the pledges of loyalty that we make, the responsibilities we have to care and to nurture and to support and to encourage and to spend time with those who are part of our family are in fact a break, a limitation on our ability to just go out and do what we impulsively want to do at the moment. The family teaches us to share and to compromise and to work together. Because as a family member, we are never totally independent. Interdependence is at the very heart of family living. But those to whom self-fulfillment is an absolute, they cannot make their peace with the family. For the family is seen to be limiting and to be coercive, a restraint on their freedoms. But isn't that precisely the point? And isn't that perhaps one of the reasons that Judaism has so emphasized the virtue of the family? For the persons whose ego is in no way trammeled, the person who feels that they have a right to go out and do their own thing regardless, that person is monstrous. For they take of life without returning to life. They demand without a return. Others have provided for them and loved them and cared them and nurtured for them when they were children and offered them support along the way, but they think only of that which will satisfy them at the moment. Obviously, one cannot simply go one's own way and be a member of a family, have a sense of true responsibility to the family. But I submit to you that it is in the process of learning to live as a family that we become human, that we learn to share and learn to be open and to be empathized and to be sensitive and to be something more than an I, an ego, a self, an appetite. And what is true of independence is true also of spontaneity. If I hear the phrase again, I will be never again, I will be satisfied. I want to be genuine in all that I feel. I want always to feel that I love those who I'm supposed to love. I don't want to enter into any relationship in which I will be asked to pledge that tomorrow I will feel as I do today, that I will have responsibilities towards those tomorrow because I may not feel towards them what I do today. Several months ago, I had a young lady, a putative bride, in my office. She spent about 2 hours trying to convince me that I ought to rewrite the wedding ceremony. Why? Because she didn't believe that there should be anything that smacked of concern with a lasting responsibility, binding ties. She wanted me to speak only of what they felt in the here and now. They didn't want to make any pledge about middle age or old age, about companionship and friendship, about sacrifice, about caring for the other when the other was sick or infirm, about all those things which are basic to the pledge of love when we give it. She enjoyed the moment. She was deeply in love in the moment. But she couldn't understand that lust must become love and love must become friendship and friendship must be nurtured along the way as we change and grow and develop over the years. Now again, isn't this precisely the point? Those who believe that the only relationships in life are those which are of the moment can never have a lasting relationship. They can only have relationships with those who are as inconsequential, who think as little of the future as they do. Part of the security we have, part of the reason that we emerge as human beings, that marriage and family are such satisfying relationships for those of us who have worked at our marriages and our families is this, that they give us a sense of security. We know that if something should happen to us today, there will be those who will pick up and carry on and nurse us and care for us and be with us. That we never be cast out and never alone and never simply a charge on the state simply because we are no longer young or handsome or virile or attractive or able to offer something that someone else wants. Spontaneity, genuineness of feeling, to be sure. But once we give ourselves to the ties of marriage and family, then we give ourselves to a set of human, give ourselves over to a set of human experiences which transcend spontaneity, which transcend the moment. We pledge time. We pledge ourselves to the future. Yes, we will care. Yes, we will sustain. Yes, we will support, come what may. In a very real sense, my questionnaire had raised an issue within the proper context. One of the problems I suspect, the unseen problems which we in the liberal religious tradition suffer, is that we have unconsciously taken over the best and the worst of some of our modern thinking. That we have assumed that whatever is contemporary, has the smacks of modernity, of being new, is somehow right. And we have been willing to go along with the new and the changeful simply because it seemed new and bright and liberating. But when the children of Israel left Egypt, they were free. And they were also a rabble, a ragtag, a mob, who within a day or two were complaining, "Return us to the flesh pots of Egypt." It wasn't until they came to Sinai and pledged themselves to the covenant and began to experience what life meant within the context of lasting relationships. It wasn't only until that moment that a rabble became a people, that the Jewish people began to emerge into significance. The test of, one of the tests of modern life, is not whether or not we can secure greater independence. Most of the battles for independence have long since been won. But the test of modern life is whether we can be more than individuals whirling about each other, hardly touching one another, alien to each other. Whether we can find true meaning in the meeting. Whether we can build open and good communities. Whether we can transform ourselves into family groupings which have beauty, in which there is loyalty and love and openness, and through these begin to develop the arts of communal living, which obviously are so distant and strange and alien to us today. Amen.